20 years ago, two men brutally beat and tortured Matthew Shepard, a 21-year-old gay college student in Laramie, Wyoming. Shepard died 6 days later, on October 12, 1998.
He had been tied to a fence, pistol whipped, and left to die. Two suspects will be charged with the murder. President Clinton today condemned the attack and said Congress should pass hate crime legislation.
But it took until 2009 for President Barack Obama to sign the Matthew Shepard Act, which updated the federal hate crimes law to include crimes motivated by a victim's actual or perceived gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability.
Time and again, we faced opposition. Time and again, the measure was defeated or delayed. Time and again, we've been reminded of the difficulty of building a nation in which we're all free to live and love as we see fit.
But a law on the books doesn't mean people are actually protected. Some states still haven't expanded their own hate crime language, and people in the transgender community say they feel especially vulnerable.
People don't understand us. People have been fired, people have been hurt, people have been jumped and killed just for being out as transgender or being found out.
20-year-old Armani Gucci is an executive board member of Trans Student Educational Resources.
Bullying and harassment is kind of at the forefront of a lot of our issues.
And for trans women of color like Armani, the bullying and harassment can be particularly severe.
Personally, people have shouted at me just walking down the street as people are driving by. They yell it out of their cars. They call names. A really close personal friend of mine, it was probably the worst experience that they had being a trans person of color, but they were literally pushed back and forth as if it were a game of monkey in the middle in the hallways at school, and it resulted in a back injury. It was that bad, and people have spit in her hair.
As transgender Americans gain more visibility, they also face increasing discrimination, harassment, and violence. Over the last 5 years, violence against this community has been on the rise, and 2018 is shaping up to be among the deadliest on record. So far, at least 22 transgender women have been murdered, most of them women of color, according to the Human Rights Campaign. But that estimate only tells us part of the story. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we begin today, National Coming Out Day, on The Takeaway. This year, transgender people have been killed in cities across the country, from Jacksonville, Florida, to Cleveland, Ohio, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Portland, Oregon. Just at the beginning of the month, Ciara Minaj Carter Frazier, a Black trans woman, was stabbed to death in Chicago. Part of the problem is that transgender deaths are often underreported and misreported. And in a few minutes, we'll speak with a ProPublica reporter about the challenges police face when investigating these crimes. But first, a look at the broader picture of these attacks. Sarah McBride is a transgender activist and the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your organization has been tracking these murders. Are you seeing a rise in attacks year over year, or could this be a case of just more attention to the issue?
Well, I think that that's a fantastic question. I think there's probably both factors at play here. There's no question that we are seeing an increase in law enforcement and media accurately reporting on hate and violence that already existed throughout this country against the transgender community. But the reality is that across the board, we are seeing an increase in hate-based violence against marginalized Americans from all backgrounds, including transgender people. And there's no question that the toxic political climate we see, the vicious rhetoric we see from many politicians at the state and federal level, the increased attention in many ways has put a spotlight on the transgender community and put many, many members of our community at danger of discrimination, harassment, and of course, fatal violence.
And we're hearing a lot, Sarah, about specifically about transgender women of color. Are they being targeted for any specific reason? Is there something that's leading to violence against that community within the transgender community specifically?
Well, every single year that we have been tracking violence against the transgender community, the vast majority of victims of this violence have been transgender women of color, and in particular, Black transgender women. And that is a byproduct of the fact that when transphobia is mixed with misogyny and racism, it can have often deadly consequences. The more prejudices a person has to interact with on any given day compounds the discrimination, compounds the barriers that are put in their way. And that when you combine these prejudices, the toxic combination of these prejudices, it can embolden and inflame existing violence. It can embolden and inflame the attacks that are coming transgender people's way. And that's one of the main reasons why we see transgender women of color so disproportionately overrepresented in the number of victims that die each year.
Sarah, how much does income and demographics outside of race have to do with this? We know that 29% of transgender respondents to the 2015 U.S. Trans Survey said they were living in poverty, 15% were unemployed, and 12% had been homeless.
One of the things we always want to make clear when we're talking about the violence facing the trans community is that in many cases, it's a hate crime. In other cases, it might not technically be deemed a hate crime, but hate is no less a factor or contributor to the violence. Because in many situations, to your point, individuals who are experiencing or facing violence are facing circumstances where violence is more likely due to institutional or systemic barriers to stable employment, to shelter, to access to goods and services that people need to live and thrive. And so when you add in all of these systemic barriers, when you add in class and poverty and economic status, it can oftentimes put people in circumstances where they're more likely to face this kind of violence.
And we mentioned that tomorrow marks 20 years since Matthew Shepard died. The Shepard Byrd Act, which was named after him, gives the Department of Justice the power to investigate and prosecute bias-motivated crimes against LGBTQ victims. Is there more of a need for protection specifically for transgender Americans?
Well, as you mentioned in your intro, there are a number of states that still do not have inclusive protections when it comes to hate crimes. But we also need more states and the federal government to pass non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people, and particularly transgender people, because as we've talked about, there are so many factors contributing to this violence. It's not just a matter of passing inclusive hate crimes. It's about making sure we have better data collection for a clear picture. And it's about making sure that transgender people are safe from discrimination that can oftentimes put them in these circumstances.
Sarah McBride is the National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
How do local police and the criminal justice system deal with murders of transgender people? Lucas Waldron is a reporter at ProPublica who's been keeping track of homicides of trans people and investigations throughout the country.
What happens often during a homicide investigation with a transgender victim is folks will look at someone's ID or how perhaps they are listed on a birth certificate, state-issued ID, and go with kind of the gender marker that is listed on that ID. Normally it's an M or an F. And so to misgender someone is to essentially call someone by a gender that they don't identify with. So it's someone who identifies as, you know, female, and you are consistently referring to them as he and him and, you know, with male pronouns. This term dead naming comes into play when you're using a name that someone does not use anymore to describe themselves. So trans folks are often, you know, given a name at birth that might match, you know, the gender, the sex that they're assigned at birth. And then later in life, you know, kind of walk away from that name and start living a different, you know, life with a different name. And so when we think about dead naming, it's a term that does not just apply to, you know, murders or homicide cases. It's kind of a term used throughout the transgender community to describe calling someone by a name that they just don't identify with anymore.
And I'm wondering how that impacts the investigations into these crimes that we're looking at.
So the way that we see this play out a lot across the country, and what I found in my reporting with my colleague Ken Schwenke, who's my co-reporter on this project, we've found that police departments are often using state-issued IDs that are often outdated to refer to homicide victims. And, you know, by nature, homicide victims can't advocate for themselves or say how they want to be identified. And so the problems we see with that are a couple different things. First, when you go to the community and you're describing someone by a name and a gender that they no longer identify with, oftentimes their community, their friends, even their family sometimes won't know who you're talking about. And that can be a really big problem in investigations of all kinds, but especially homicide investigations. So when you go into the community and you say, you know, Michael has died, or have you seen Michael recently? And folks are saying, I don't know Michael. You know, this friend of mine is someone that I know by a very different name and by, you know, a gender that might not line up with what Michael implies. So we see that as a barrier to investigations kind of all across the country. And we looked at some specific states to get a better understanding of how police were consistently releasing names to the public that just didn't match up with what people knew these people by. So, you know, there are some resources available to police, but one of the things we found over and over again, we looked into 85 different homicides of transgender folks. And in every case we, you know, called, we contacted the police department or the sheriff's office. And what we heard over and over again was not so much that they were, you know, like grappling with this issue or weren't sure what to do. It was just they had absolutely no policy or no plan for how to interact with the transgender community about homicides, but also just more generally speaking. And so that's kind of where we're seeing some police departments start, is trying to kind of create a policy to say, oh, we're not going to, you know, consistently dead name someone, or we're going to try to figure out how someone preferred to be called or identified, both because it's a more respectful way to treat that person, but also because it is actually going to make our investigation easier.
Is there anything that's leading to sort of a culture of impunity when it comes to cases like this?
I think there are a few things. One thing that we heard from trans women, especially trans women in Jacksonville, Florida, where we've seen these three murders of trans women this year that have been unsolved, the women there told us that it felt like there was a culture of impunity because, you know, it didn't feel like there were resources being put into looking into murders of, you know, poor Black trans women. I think we see that, you know, outside of the trans community as well. But folks not really placing a priority on the lives of the, you know, people in our communities that are poor, that don't have access to, you know, the resources that other people have. So I think there's a structural problem with policing in that way. In the cases that we looked at, there was a wide range of different situations. You know, some women were killed in hotels, and in many situations, those cases are unsolved. It's like the police come and they kind of take stock of the scene, and then we don't really hear anything about, you know, ever arrests being made. The investigation is just sort of ongoing forever. In other cases, you know, domestic violence cases where the perpetrator might be much easier to find, there is a little bit more accountability. But, you know, by and large, in most of the cases we looked at, the community, at least, and the folks who knew the women who had been killed felt like there really wasn't any accountability, you know, related to their friend's death.
And you're a reporter who's been covering this extensively, but also as a trans man yourself, do you feel like there are any things that you see that could be done to improve this?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. As a trans person myself, this was a story that felt really important to me. I've had my own experiences, you know, struggling to get a gender marker change and a name change on my IDs. And, you know, I had issues accessing that even given the fact that I, you know, identify on the masculine side of the spectrum and I'm white and I don't have a lot of the barriers that other folks have. So what I see is that we really do need local police to have more consistent policies about how they approach trans folks or folks that they don't know what their gender identity might be. And I think one of those solutions to that problem is just asking people, asking the community, how did your friend identify? How can we treat them respectfully? You know, what can we do to make sure that we're not consistently calling them by a name that they didn't go by? And I think that's really the first step, is folks just talking to the community more.
Lucas Waldron is a reporter at ProPublica. Lucas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.